It isn't useful, music isn't, unless it develops our powers of audition. But most musicians can't hear a single sound. They listen only to the relationship between two or more sounds. Music for them has nothing to do with their powers of audition, but only to do with their powers of observing relationships. In order to do this, they have to ignore all the crying babies, fire engines, telephone bells, coughs that happen to occur during their auditions. Actually, if you run into people who are really interested in hearing sounds, you're apt to find them fascinated by the quiet ones. Did you hear that? They will say.
John Cage, in his lecture on indeterminacy, recorded in 1958. It's a summary of the principles that would guide his whole career: the acceptance of environmental sounds as music, the creation of a new way of listening, and a rejection of conventional models of composition. It was a philosophy that Cage was always happy to talk about. Here he is on his definition of music.
I call sound music the experience of listening. If you use the experience of listening and pay attention to what you hear, then what you hear, even if it's a mere silence, as I've shown in my work, appears aesthetically. That is to say, you enjoy the experience of hearing it. There is no absence of sound. We live surrounded by sound. So that the question is whether we're irritated or whether we use it.
How was this epoch-making approach to music formed? Experimentation was in Cage's genes. His father was a celebrated inventor, among whose achievements were an early version of the submarine. Cage found his own spirit of individualism in 1930, when, at the age of 17, he left Los Angeles for Europe. And in Paris, he made contact with architects and painters, as well as with musicians. Returning to the States in 1931, Cage's attentions turned again towards music, and especially the works of Arnold Schoenberg, who arrived in 1933 in California as an exile from Nazi Germany. Cage was virtually penniless in this period, but he sponsored his musical studies by lecturing to groups of Santa Monica housewives, charging $2.50 for a series of talks on modern music and art. He was also writing experimental, mathematically constructed pieces, and it was the composer Henry Cowell who advised him to study with Schoenberg.
I wanted to study with Schoenberg, and when I went to him, asked him to teach me, he said, "You probably can't afford my price." And I said, "Don't mention it, because I don't have any money." And he said, "Will you devote your life to music?" And I unhesitatingly said, "Yes." It sounds foolish to say that I thought he was extraordinary, but I mean that in every sense. I thought of him as being superior to other people. He was a lawgiver, but he was a law taker backer too. He would encourage you to take freedom, and then you would do that. And then he'd say, "Why do you break the rules?" You know? Then you'd follow the rules, and then you'd say, "Why don't you take a little freedom?" and so on. So that nothing ever satisfied him. I worshipped him.
But although Cage was enamored of Schoenberg, he couldn't accept one of the major tenets of Schoenberg's teaching, the importance of harmony.
Harmony, you see, is not itself a sound. It's a connection between sounds. And that connection doesn't exist in sounds themselves, though the theory books all say that it does. Harmony is a theory, and what I would like is to have sounds be free of that theory. And when I didn't yet know that, and thought that I should study harmony, since to be a musician you should study harmony, counterpoint, etc., I could learn the rules, but I had no facility, I had no feeling. And from Schoenberg's point of view, he said that I wouldn't be able to compose music. This was after having taught me for 2 years. And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Not having a feeling for harmony, you'll come to a wall that you won't be able to get through." But then he was forgetting that I had promised him to devote my life to music. And so I said, "Well, then I'll simply have to spend my life beating my head against that wall."
Schoenberg admired Cage, but saw him not as a composer, but rather, like his father, as an inventor of genius. Cage may have been banging his head against a wall, but his musical explorations produced rich and strange sonic discoveries. He found a way of making music that could exist independently of harmony by composing pieces for percussion ensembles. And he expanded his view of the usefulness of his music by collaborating as percussionist and as pianist with dancers and filmmakers.
It was a suggestion from Oscar Fischinger, who was an abstract filmmaker. The idea was that I would write percussion music to go with one of his films. He was at the time using Brahms' Hungarian Dances. It would have been a step forward for both of us, to bring his films and my music together. At any rate, he said while we were working together, everything in the world has its own spirit, and that spirit is released by setting it in vibration. It was that statement of his that sent me absolutely exploring the world from the point of view of sound. When I would show a musician some of my work, he would say, that's not the way to write music. And I said, how should one write? And then he gave me perfectly good advice. He said, write the way Mozart did. What I was doing was not satisfactory from a musical point of view, but it was perfectly useful from the point of view of a dancer. And it was perfectly interesting if from the point of view of an artist. You see, when I came to work with modern dancers, they were revolting against following the music as the ballet had done. And they wanted the music to follow the dance. When I saw that there was this kind of political situation rampant, what I wanted to provide was a space of time that was empty of both music and dance, which could have both arts go into it independently of one another, so that there wouldn't be a hierarchical situation.
The most important of Cage's relationships with dancers, and one of the most important creative relationships of the 20th century, was his partnership with Merce Cunningham. Cage was the music director of Cunningham's company for more than 20 years. They became partners for life, professionally and personally. Around the time of his first involvement with Cunningham, most of Cage's music was scored for percussion or his one-man percussion orchestra, the Prepared Piano. But Cage's life also reached a crisis point in the mid-40s.
It was a crisis both in my musical life and in my, so to speak, private life. It was at that time that the divorce with Xenia took place, and I considered being psychoanalyzed. It was at that time that I also determined to find an other reason for making music than that of communication. We had all been taught, perhaps people are still being taught, to have something to say and say it.
Whereas you said, I have nothing to say and I am saying it.
Right.
And that is
poetry. Right. But I was still having feelings and expressing them as well as I could and finding that people didn't understand. So I gave that up. I felt in need of great change. So much so that I went to a psychiatrist. He was a Jungian. This psychiatrist said, I can fix you so that you will write more music than you do now. And I was alarmed because I was already writing too much music, it seemed to me.
Cage talking in 1987 to Peter Dickinson. Well, instead of finding succor in psychoanalysis, Cage was drawn to Indian philosophy and Zen Buddhism, both sources of spiritual insight that would define his later approach to music and to life. He formulated a philosophy of non-intention as an aesthetic approach. But as well as Eastern spirituality, there was another major influence on this momentous musical turning point.
I felt myself at a crossroads. in the late 40s. It was a result of many things concurring. One was an actual experience of going into the anechoic chamber at Harvard University. It seemed more reasonable and more useful to the society if I took this other direction, which I did.
The question for Cage was how to implement this course of non-intentionality. And what provided the practical means of realizing it was the Chinese I Ching.
I was first introduced to the I Ching by Lou Harrison before I went to Seattle, and it made no impression on me, but I remembered it. And then later, Christian Wolff brought me a copy that his father had just published of the Bollingen edition, and at that point when I saw it, and I'm speaking now of the chart with the hexagrams, I've suddenly understood how to write the music of changes.
It was at that point that Feldman called out excitedly, "You've hit it."
Yes. Yes.
It was a kind of eureka.
Yeah. Oh, we were at a point with his work and my work and Christian Wolff's work, and with the charmed help of David Tudor, we were at a very intoxicating point where things were happening quickly and richly.
Just after the music of changes, Cage composed 4 minutes 33 seconds, his infamous silent piece. This, for many, was the moment that Cage broke with any conventional kind of composition, since the piece appeared to authorise nothing, silence, as music. But this was not a compositional joke for Cage. Instead, it was a logical result of his work with the I Ching. For pianist David Tudor, who gave the first performance of 4 minutes 33, the piece is a rigorous, even systematic compositional exercise. And for Cage himself, it required courage and inspiration to write the piece, something he received from one of his closest creative colleagues.
I wrote a text, which has never been published, called A Composer's Confessions. And in it, I described the silent piece before I wrote it. But I didn't give myself the right to write it until I saw the white paintings of Bob.
Bob was Robert Rauschenberg, an artist who'd also worked with the Cunningham Company, and whose totally white and black paintings offered a similar challenge to viewers as 4 minutes 33 did for listeners, to see the beauty of an apparently blank canvas, the subtlety of minute changes of light and atmosphere. Cage often felt that his own work was better appreciated by painters and writers than it was by musicians. And his creativity, too, later extended to literature and the visual arts.
I didn't know when I was very young whether I would be a musician or a painter or a writer. And actually, I'm very fortunate because through music and through the fact that not everyone understood my music, it became necessary for me to write. And then in the course of making music, the magnetic tape recording became of such high fidelity that one could make music on tape. And then it became clear that space and time had a certain equivalence, so that much of my notation became graphic. And that led people interested in visual arts to invite me to make etchings. So that where early I made a decision in favor of music, music has been generous and brought me back to all the things that interested me.
In the 60s, Cage's books of writings, lectures and essays like Silence and A Year from Monday brought him to a wider audience than his musical performances ever could. And his interests extended to a vision of social and political change, reflecting his dedication to the ideas of Buckminster Fuller, Marshall McLuhan and Henry David Thoreau, as well as, briefly, Mao Zedong.
Well, it was through that experience I had of going to Hawaii, which I tell about in the first installment of the diary, How to Improve the World. I had been invited by the university, which was to the south of the Wahoo, but I lived with Jasper Johns and Lois Long on the north side of the island, and we went through a tunnel to get home each evening. So, or in the morning too, to get to the university. So I noticed that at the top there was a crenellation of the mountain that was tunneled. And I asked people what this crenellation was. And they said, well, the people at the north used to fight the people at the south. And they used those crenellations to protect themselves when they were shooting poisoned arrows at the other people. And now the place being tunneled, the very idea that people to the north of the island used to fight with the people to the south is just silliness. And Buckminster Fuller's view of the world is that it's one island, you see. So I equated Wahoo with the world, and all of his ideas and McLuhan's ideas fit to make a world where we won't fight with one another, where the history of having fought will be as foolish as it is on the island of Wahoo. If you become open to the world outside of your ideas about it, I mean to say really attentive to the world outside of you, which you can perceive through your eyes and through your ears primarily, then you become a Thoreau unto yourself. The pavement that you're standing on can become fascinating. The way the light falls on two different Coca-Cola bottles can be fascinating, etc. So that we come to a poetic awareness of the uniqueness of each experience, of the necessity to have the experience at the moment that it presents itself, because it's constantly changing. There's no other time to live than each moment.
For Cage, the act of listening embodied these ideals of acceptance and openness. And for all the challenges that his music offers to the conventions of the concert hall, it's his philosophy of listening that's one of his lasting legacies. And at the start of this weekend of Cage's music, here he is on How to Listen.
It would be a good thing to keep the ears open. And I think the mind can sometimes get in the way. I don't mean the empty mind, but I mean a mind with preconceptions sometimes gets in the way. An empty mind that is nevertheless alert, the kind of empty mind that you would have that would get you across the street safely if you were walking in a thick traffic. I think that kind of attention would be useful.
The voice of John Cage in interviews preserved in the BBC Archive. Cage on Cage was presented by Tom Service and produced by Tony Cheevers. And Tom Service will be back on Sunday introducing a special edition of Music Matters devoted to Cage. You can hear that on BBC Radio 3 at 6 o'clock, sandwiched between two more concerts in the BBC Symphony Orchestra's John Cage Uncaged weekend.